At the end there is Sophie Long. Sophie is PhD candidate at the School of Politics at Queen's. She's researching civic loyalism and working with loyalists to co-produce a political theory of loyalism. And she's from East Belfast. If you've never read any of Sophie's works, like Sophie would publish a lot of stuff online, and it's brilliant stuff. It's the sort of thing you read and you think, I wish I could write like that, you know. Like it's great stuff. So the second person is Councillor Julianne Corr Johnson. Julianne's a member of the Progressive Unionist Party and describes herself as a proud unionist, an unashamed loyalist, and an equal rights campaigner. She was drawn to politics during the Flags protest in 2012. Her focus is on securing a better quality of life for all of her constituents and returning loyalism to the political stage so it can help to shape a positive peace. Julianne and I actually have something in common. We both went to the same school and we were chatting last week, and it turned out that the same teacher who bawled out Julianne and told her she'd never make anything of herself also bawled out me one time and made me cry whenever I was 13. So we bonded over that experience. And then last person on my left here is John Sue, whose real name is Johnny Hamilton. So Johnny is a hip-hop artist who's from Rathcoole and now based in Manchester in England. So Johnny released his first full-length album last year called The Troubles, which he describes as an audio autobiography. And over the last 2 years, Johnny's been running a lot of poetry and rap workshops in both Republican and Loyalist working class communities, so we'll look forward to hearing all about that. But so first of all, we'll hear from Sophie. So the presentation should last probably an hour or just under, and then the plan is to have a period of questions and answers after that. So we'll ask Sophie to start.
Thanks, Rosh. Is this, you all hear me? Don't want to be craning my neck and, you know, looking stranger than I will when I finish this. Okay, so first, many thanks to the organisers for facilitating the panel. I'm going to read the paper and sort of deviate and talk like a human, but I am trained to do this. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak as best I can about loyalism and hopefully begin some productive conversations, which 17 years post-agreement are desperately needed. Thanks to Dr. Dave McGee for inviting me to participate. Dave's worked with many groups in peace-building initiatives for the past 10 years. When he was asked to organise this, his primary concern was to allow loyalism to speak for itself. Just round this way? No problem.
Closer.
A wee bit closer, sorry. Not loud enough. Okay. Hear me now? Right. No? Is that any good? Closer again? I don't want to sound like the DUP. Sorry. Okay. So Dave wanted loyalism to speak for itself, and I'm confident, given the calibre of my fellow panellists, that this will happen this afternoon. Loyalism will speak for itself. And the aim of this talk is to generate discussion, a broader discussion than the one which usually takes place when we mention loyalism. And to do this, I'm going to focus on three issues, which are quite abstract issues, and ask you to consider how they might affect our readings of loyalism, and indeed, if we might begin to take loyalists seriously as fellow citizens on their own terms. So that's a hard thing to do, is to take someone on their own terms. The three issues I'm going to discuss are class, violence, or social unrest, and respect. I believe the three have significant roles to play in how we can better understand and interact more positively with loyalism. The first thing I'm going to do is the thing which Dave said was impossible, is to define what I mean by loyalism. In acknowledging it as an umbrella term, you don't negate the potential to try and describe it. It's a subjective thing. You know, my loyalism is different to Julianne, you know. So you just recognise the internal diversity of the identity. But in common parlance, loyalism is now a pejorative term. Tony Novacell, I don't know if any of you have read Tony Novacell's excellent book, I recommend it. It was called Northern Ireland's Lost Opportunity, The Frustrated Promise of Political Loyalism. In his book, he defined loyalism as armed unionism. unionists willing to take up arms to defend the union. And throughout the past 103 years, an armed unionist has had vastly different moral and social meanings for people. If you think back to Carson's time, those guys being armed was seen as a noble defence of their constitutional position. If you were to find an armed paramilitary gang now and ask people if they viewed them in the same way they see Carson, they say, absolutely not, right? There's no moral capital there anymore in that. So the class stratifications of armed unionism changed in the 1960s, I think, and today we see the consequences for those who identify as loyalist. The second popular definition comes from another academic, Jim McCauley. Jim would have written some working papers with David Irvine over the years. McCauley was one of the key proponents of what was termed new loyalism. And when we talk about new loyalism emerging in the early 90s, we really mean thinking loyalism or Irvinian loyalism. Loyalism which was palatable to a broad swathe of society. This is new loyalism. However, recent research from Richard Reid has contradicted the notion there was anything new constitutively about this loyalism. Loyalism was always a thinking identity, and I would argue an identity comfortable with criticising unionism and the state. However, Macaulay's definition remains a useful one. Loyalism is unionism through a working class lens. Okay? And the worldview is totally different. The interests, the aspirations, the fears are totally different. And that's something you kind of have to remember when you're looking at what loyalism is doing, how it expresses itself, is that lens. I've developed my own definition, which I will discuss if there's time. Some people might contend. But the two features I just outlined are important to bear in mind. So loyalism, according to Novacell, is armed unionism. According to Macaulay, is unionism through a working class lens. So, if the identity which you subscribe to is most commonly understood as either A, violent, or B, working class, and this is where I'm going to move to now, the structure, right? If you're working class and violent, how successfully will you navigate a post-imperial, post-industrial, neoliberal society? Right? How do you display competency in that environment? Right? Furthermore, as a working class person who is prepared to subscribe to violent methods of achieving your ends, how much respect will you receive in such a society? Class, violence and respect, all three are connected, all three matter for how we understand loyalism. Just check I'm okay for time here. I tend to love the sound of my own voice. Right, 15 minutes, we're good. So, this is the context which I wish to set before I offer my perspective on loyalism. Those structures which loyalists operate within and the opportunities and limitations of those structures. Class, violence and respect are the three themes I wish to explore in this talk before turning to how we might positively engage with loyalism and indeed why we ought to. I believe there's an impetus on the rest of society to engage with loyalism. Because you can't just point at a group and say, the things which you do are unpleasant to me, you're awfully noisy and a bit of a disruption. You wouldn't change, would you? If then when loyalists try to engage politically, you respond as if they'd never altered their behaviour, right? Everybody else has responsibility too. So, I'm just going to talk about loyalism in relation to the British working class. I think there's a connection there and the way that they responded to. So, Northern Ireland is often described as a place apart. We're quite like a neurotic people. We think we're very special. Our trauma is particularly traumatic. The conflict, the war, the troubles, they make us different somehow from other British and Irish peoples, because we're all British and Irish, of course. Yet I want to suggest that loyalism, as part of a broader British working class, are now subject to the same challenges as their fellow citizens across the Irish Sea. Those challenges are summarised most succinctly in the subtitle of Owen Jones' first book, Chavs, which was The Demonisation of the Working Class. I'll outline this argument before explaining some of the other restricting factors on loyalist political participation. And this is kind of why I do what I do and why I care. Loyalists should be participating politically. They represent a particular group in society who aren't actually represented by mainstream unionism. So this is where we have to get to, right? Loyalists have to be back on the stage. So, just going to talk about the UK riots very briefly. When violence erupted on the streets of some of the UK's major cities in August 2011, there was a clear delineation between the reactions of those in the political left and their counterparts on the right. For the former, the left, there were structural explanations for the frustrations and alienation of the United Kingdom's young working class, mainly male citizens, who for a series of reasons engaged in public unrest for 6 days during England's summer of discontent. For the political right, however, most concisely depicted in Prime Minister David Cameron's response, those thugs we saw last week do not represent us, nor do they represent our young people, and they will not drag us down. And then he suggested scrapping the Human Rights Act, so you can see where he's going. 16 months later, when Belfast City Centre saw similar scenes of disorder due to the change in flag policy and unionist leafleting, Cameron issued a similar statement. In no way are these people being loyal or standing up for Britishness. Violence is absolutely unjustified in these and other circumstances. Unjustified. Syria, unjustified, right? We don't like violence when it stops people shop, and it's all right if we're going to get some stuff out of it. So, academic research into the 2011 riots and flag protests found recurring themes which served to ascribe reason and motivation to the protesters. They found that both cases were stimulated and sustained by a collective sense of perceived injustice. Something's not fair, something's not right. We're angry, we're not sure what to do, but we're just not happy. This was amplified by feelings of social dislocation, lack of hope for the future, and ritualised experiences of disrespect, both from the state and other members of the polity. Social movement theory would say that these phenomena are the primary drivers behind public protest and political violence. There was a sociologist at the LSE who said something really interesting about the riots. He said, these young guys, and it was 87% men, and half of them had been stopped and searched by the police in the past year. A third of them had lost 3 MA. These are the guys who were put in prison for the riots. He said, when you tell someone that they've got no future, they've got nothing to lose, so they experience an intense sense of the present. So for a lot of them, going toe-to-toe with the police was tremendously empowering and exciting because they hated the police and they never had a chance to confront authority or tell their story. So this was, you know... And there's no future to throw away, and that's a dangerous position to put anybody in. So in manifesting the rejection of the status quo, the rioters and the flag protesters were willing to disobey the state. They're dissenting. And there is a real... I believe dissent is a social good. Yet when they did so, they were dismissed as un-British. These are the words of the Conservative Party. Un-British, criminal, pathological, and critically unrepresentative of us. And this not-in-my-name tagline has been frequently invoked by the contented classes of Belfast in seeking to exclude loyalists from the city centre. 15 years ago, a well-known loyalist politician suggested that the word loyalist had been cultivated by a particular group to serve political and indeed psychosocial ends. It's a lengthy quote, but it's one worth reproducing. And you'll probably be able to figure out the loyalist politician. Let me give you my understanding of when and how loyalism was first defined. Loyalism was first defined around 1971 to 72, when the great and the good within unionism decided that they needed to have a distancing process between themselves and those who, rather than talking a good fight or an argument, were actually physically prepared to fight. They embarked then on a process of developing for themselves a position which separated them from any sense of complicity in the problem that is Northern Ireland. I suppose it is best epitomised by identifying these people with those who live on the Gold Coast, an area outside Belfast where property values are very high, where the quality of life and the remuneration are substantial. The view of this group of unionists probably was that if all of the bad people would just go away, what a wonderful place it would be. Those who are happy with neoliberal peace are fundamentally opposed to the idea that loyalists, many of whom live in the deprived inner urban hinterlands of Belfast, might wish to enter the city centre and selfishly disrupt their meals, drinks and excursions into Victoria Square. For them, who goes there anyway? For them, cities are spaces of consumption. Consumption is their culture. We therefore see little attempt to navigate the loyalist cultural world, which to the contented classes appears loud, unruly, and ultimately a threat to peace and stability. The political leaders, who act as our moral entrepreneurs, have little sympathy for structural explanations of social unrest or political violence, particularly when perpetuated by the working classes, whose morality is always under question. As Theresa May surmised in 2011 in relation to the riots, the only cause of crime is a criminal. There we have it. Expand the prison system, abolish the Human Rights Act, and consolidate our position as Little America. Many of you will be rightly appalled by the Home Secretary's narrow and limited analysis. Of course there are other causes of crime. Poverty, low educational attainment, low self-esteem, among others. Will we afford the same generosity of mind towards loyalism as we would those rioters? Indeed, there's no need to deny the Britishness, which we're all too eager to appropriate. Britain has a proud history of protest movements, which won democratic rights for some of its poorest citizens. In the 18th century, while David Hume and Adam Smith worked out the relevant theories, ordinary Britons fought about who had the right to dispose of land, labour, capital and commodities. The participants in the early relief riots were defending the moral economy, and the moral economy is economic justice coupled with a working definition of exploitation. In 1932, the residents of the Shanklin Falls Road collaborated in the outdoor relief riots. Is public protest or rioting really un-British, and is it always immoral? The Chartists, the Suffragettes, the Miners' Strikes, the National Hunger March of 32, the 26th General Strike, the Battle of Wargrave, the anti-war protest, Brixton and Toxteth riots, pro-Tibetan protest, Green and Women's Common, Peace Camp, the anti-Vietnam riots in Grosvenor Square, the poll tax riots, and many more undermine this claim. Why did they riot? Why do people riot? A well-known civil rights campaigner offers some insight. I think we must see that riots do not develop out of thin air. Certain conditions continue to exist in our society which must be condemned as vigorously as we condemn riots. The conditions, structures. But in the final analysis, a riot is the language of the unheard. And what it is, this country has failed to hear. It has failed to hear that the plight of the poor has worsened over the last few years. It has failed to hear that the promises of freedom and justice have not been met. And it has failed to hear that large segments of society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than justice, equality and humanity. And so in a real sense, our nation's summers of riots are caused by our nation's winters of delay. And as long as this country postpones justice, we stand in the position of having these recurrences of violence and riots over and over again. Social justice and progress are the absolute guarantors of riot prevention. I would add that from my own research, and indeed from everyday conversations, that we must always also consider the human need for respect or esteem. Psychologists place esteem just above the need for physical security in the hierarchy of needs, and esteem sits prior to self-actualization, as in realising your potential and living a fully human life. So esteem is a necessary precursor to self-actualisation and it's vital to our psychosocial development. Esteem is also a social good. We grant one another respect when we see that the other has behaved in a socially useful or morally appealing way. In order, however, to give respect, we must first engage and see the other person as they truly are on their own terms. And this requires affording them the opportunity to tell their stories. I worry, however, that we have become comfortable with scapegoating the Ulster folk devil that is contemporary loyalism. And an excerpt from a recent series of interviews illustrates this point. So I've been doing some research on loyalism in the left, pretty much because I've been attacked quite a lot by the left anytime I say that loyalists are concerned with the condition of their housing, education, shops in their area, and they go, UVF. So I decided to do some research and see what the difficulties were. This is a quote from a prominent trade unionist who's a member of the Communist Party. I know many on the left who, when loyalism rioted, went into self-destruct, destroyed its own communities, these people gloated. They said, the shoe's on the other foot and loyalists can't take it. Anyone who has even undertaken a cursory reading of political loyalism story knows that very few working class loyalists benefited from 50 years of unionist misrule. It is not fair then to punish today's loyalists for the sins of unionist fathers. Nor is it acceptable to retain a thin understanding of loyalism as a violent working-class identity undeserving of our respect. We must, therefore, if we're committed to peace, reconciliation and social justice, come down from the comfortable and lofty position on the moral high ground and begin the uncomfortable journey towards understanding the complexity of the conflict here and its legacy. O'Leary and McGarry argues that a cold peace, which doesn't offer expression and voice to all communities, is in reality a Hobbesian latent war. We have fed and watered the cold peace and are left in a scenario of perpetually latent war. Just in closing, I'd like to ask you to consider which parties and which groupings have reached out the hand of true reconciliation and taken risks for peace. The loyalist political role in bringing about the ceasefires and selling the peace process to their constituents is now confined to the margins of history. It needs to be re-explored, and the political parties who undertook that pioneering work deserve the opportunity to build a warm and positive peace. Further, we all have a role to play in insisting upon a caring, inclusive society. If not for anything else, to ensure the tragedy of the Troubles does not ever happen again. In order to do this, we must abandon the black and white narratives of old and share responsibility for this place. To quote a contributor to the LSE research into the 2011 riots, if we cannot provide our young people with a future, it is we who are committing a crime. And I'm done.